This is the QoraCast. I'm Jeff Meyerson. Lisa Galarno is a Quora top writer with over 2,000 followers and 3,000 posts in a variety of topics. Her employment background includes stints in cryptology, telegram singing, and commercial anthropology, which she currently works in today. When earning her PhD, Lisa studied the anthropology of online gamers, traveling to 13 different countries to study behaviors in different environments. Lisa Galarno, welcome to the QoraCast.
Hello, how are you?
All right, well, let's get started with a discussion of your work, which is in the field of commercial anthropology. You work at SDL, whose stated vision is to create compelling, profitable, global customer experiences. Describe the field of commercial anthropology and give me some idea of what your work entails.
Sure. Okay, well, let me just give you a really short little primer on anthropology in general, just in case you don't know. Because anthropology has sort of a unique worldview, I guess, which is kind of the perspective I bring to bear on a lot of my work. So anthropology began as a discipline in the social sciences in the 1800s. And it began really with a lot of people who were very concerned about cultures around the world that were being colonized and interacted with by, you know, Western and other cultures, and what the effect might be on those cultures. So very concerned about the idea of, oh my gosh, all this stuff is happening, these very pure, innocent, primitive people are being exposed to the modern world and modern civilization, and we have to do everything possible to record what their cultures are like in their pure form. So that was sort of the roots of anthropology. Since then, it's grown quite a bit, and there are all sorts of different kinds of anthropology, including medical anthropology, food anthropology, kind of every sort of thing you can imagine. But the thing that anthropology is most concerned with are notions of culture, which is basically, you know, the set of beliefs and behaviors that bind a group of people together and the various manifestations thereof. So artifacts of culture, things like that. And then the other thing that anthropology is very concerned with is context. So there's this idea that nothing actually happens in a vacuum. No individual is raised in a vacuum. Everything happens within a cultural context, and that cultural context needs to be recognized when you are doing work to understand the individual. So the conversation that an anthropologist would have with a psychologist, as an example, would be something along the lines of, okay, great, it's wonderful to study individuals in an individual sense. However, there are all of these other factors that come into play that help determine how an individual grows and develops over time. And those things need to be taken into account as well. So moving now to the idea of commercial anthropology, this has really sprung up in the last 20 or so years. The idea being, particularly in a very digital world, that the best way for us to develop technologies that are relevant and useful to humans is by understanding what human behaviors already exist and what can be done to leverage and enhance those experiences. So does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So the work that I do with SDL is has been related both to social intelligence, which is an area of interest for me as well, social and collective intelligence. The idea that we are greater than the sum of our parts when it comes to intelligence, and when you're able to unite more than one person in a group, for instance, you often get that wisdom of crowds phenomena that I think we've heard about. And that it's just very interesting, the things that you see emerge from group activity. So I guess that's really where my interest lies. The work at SDL now is related to customer experience. So there's been a big revolution in the last few years, pointing out to a lot of organizations that, you know, in the fast forward, digitally enabled future, organizations can't continue to do business as usual. They can't market the way they've done traditionally. They can't advertise the way they've done traditionally, and they can't operate or give service to their customers in the same ways that they have. Not only can they not, you know, as sort of a mandate, but they're also missing an opportunity if they attempt to just kind of, you know, go for business as usual. Social media opens all sorts of doors to crowdsourcing of, you know, information sharing and all sorts of things like that. So there's really a tremendous amount of opportunity once organizations can shift their thinking from, you know, we're doing business the way we want to do business because it's useful for us and we like our processes and revenue is, of course, our most important endeavor, to actually we're really focused on just developing extremely good experiences and relationships with customers and expect that our business success will rest on that foundation.
So this shift towards, I guess, is this a shift towards user experience that you're describing, or?
So now I'll explain the difference between customer experience and user experience. So user experience is an aspect of customer experience. So I would describe customer experience as the entirety of a customer's experience, inclusive of user experience. User experience tends to focus on the efforts of customers when they're in that role of being a user of technology, of devices, of websites, of applications, of all of those sorts of things. So that's really the difference.
Okay, and when I think commercial anthropology, I mean, I think what the version of commercial anthropology that you just defined is sort of using anthropology or applying principles of anthropology to improving business in general, or improving the way that organizations work in order to improve business. But I guess the first thing that I thought of when you said commercial anthropology, or well, when you told me in the message, you know, that you were, your main work is concerned with commercial anthropology, is I was thinking that was advertising. You know, I thought commercial, obviously that word pertains to advertising, or can pertain to advertising.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Well, I mean, that's definitely a component. I mean, advertising comes into play when you're thinking about customer experiences and the customer journey, and how you communicate your offerings or potential offerings to customers. But no, this goes even further. So let me give you a really good example. So Procter & Gamble, probably 10 or 15 years ago, went into a bunch of homes as a research project because they were interested in figuring out what new products could they develop. So they went into a bunch of people's homes. This practice is called ethnography. It's one of the core research methods in anthropology, but also in sociology and other disciplines as well. Went into various homes and watched people having dinner, and watched women in particular preparing dinner, cleaning up after dinner, all of these kinds of things. And what they discovered is that it's very important for a lot of women that after dinner, the house, you know, be completely clean, the kitchen be completely clean and ready for tomorrow. So, you know, they load the dishwasher, they do the dishes, they do all these things. And then they discovered that all these women were pulling out the mop bucket and mopping the floors before, you know, they then went into the living room to settle down to watch some TV or relax. Well, women were doing this because they felt like they had to, but what they reported, you know, throughout the study was that they hated it, hated the mop bucket. So as a result, Procter & Gamble started asking itself questions. well, what can we do now as an organization to fulfill this need? That's actually a latent need. It's not something that women would ever in a focus group even hold their hands up and say, you know, we really hate the mop bucket and we need a better solution. But by going into homes and observing what people were doing and attempting to do, which is perhaps even more important, they were able to think about products that they could develop, and they developed the Swiffer as a result. So they came up with a really, you know, quick and effective method, and now they have a whole line of products. You know, the basic Swiffer, which is the anti-static device, and then also mops and all sorts of things as well. So you actually don't really see mops and mop buckets in people's houses as much anymore. So that's a really good example.
Okay, that makes sense. So moving on in topics, you have a lot of interesting answers on Quora. I mean, you have a lot of answers in general, usually when I'm preparing for an interview, like I browse my interviewee's profile and their recent history, and I try to find some material that I can fit into discrete topic buckets. But I read some particular answers of yours that I had trouble fitting into like a specific context other than just being an interesting answer that I'd like to discuss. So the first one of these is a response that you had to the question, what was the worst position you ever had, like job, what was the worst job position you ever had, and what made it so bad? And your response was that you had a job as a telemarketer for a prearranged funeral planning, which you quit almost immediately to do something equally unusual.
Yeah, that was an interesting time in my life. So one of the things, I don't know if this came up in your reading of my various answers, but I joined the Army at age 17, and I was in the Army till I was 19, and got out and had a very strange set of skills. I could speak 5 languages because I was a linguist in the military and I had studied other languages and been an exchange student and this and that. But I couldn't do anything else. Like, that was literally my only skill. So I spent some time trying to find work, and you know, I frequently got the overqualified thing, you know, this and that. I think people looked at me and could see I was a bit of a troublemaker or something. So I had so many jobs, you wouldn't believe, like every kind of random imaginable job. And in this particular case, yeah, I had heard about this telemarketing job. I thought, sure, I'm a pretty social person. I can talk to people on the phone, no problem. Never occurred to me, right, what the actual topic of telemarketing would be. I mean, I just assumed, oh, I'd be calling people and selling them, you know, insurance or something. So I get to the place, and they hadn't told me before I was hired, which is really interesting. They didn't tell me until, like, I showed up to work what the actual work was going to be. So they had compiled lists of old people living in trailer parks. And we were calling them, asking them if they had arranged their funerals yet. And the thing that was crazy about it is about 50% of the people were actually super pleasant. And we're like, oh, yeah, well, you know, actually, yeah, I've already got my plot. Thank you very much. I mean, it was like that.
But so did you make it? Did you make any sales?
Oh, I don't know if I did. I was trying to set up appointments. Like, we were setting up appointments.
Oh, okay, I see.
To go to their house. And, I mean, a couple of people agreed to do this. And the thing that, though, that really tugged at my heart at the time was I could tell that some of these people were doing it just because they were, frankly, kind of, yeah, have a salesperson come to my house. Great. We'll talk about plots and funeral arrangements and all of that. So on the second day, I was there and I was thinking to myself, my gosh, I actually really, really am not enjoying this experience. And I look across the parking lot of the little office park, and there was signage for this company that I actually knew. This was in Sacramento where I grew up, called Monkey Business, which was a singing telegram business. And I thought to myself, I'm going to go over there and see if they have any jobs, because that sounds fun. Because my mother had ordered singing telegrams a couple times for people, and so I sort of knew what it was all about. So I wandered over there, and they said, yeah, we're actually looking for people to do telegrams. Here's some scripts and some video to show you how it's done. Take this away, come back, we'll audition you. And
did you have like singing experience or performing experience beforehand?
You know, I had done some drama in high school. You know, I definitely didn't have performance anxiety of any sort. You know, I had done a tiny bit of singing. I wasn't like a great singer. I never was a great singer, honestly, but I was pretty good with the rest of it. So they hired me, and I had a whole bunch of characters. This was actually a very funny time in my life because I was there for 2 or 3 years. And I had a bunch of characters, and basically I had a costume trunk in the trunk of my car. And on a typical Friday night, they would give me 5 or 6 slips with addresses, you know, and this is pre-GPS, so I'm having to find these places, right, myself, and a set of instructions. And so what they would do is when they set up an appointment for a telegram, they would ask the person who was ordering it, you know, for some details about the person. So, you know, what's their name? What kind of car do they drive? What kind of work do they do? Et cetera, et cetera. So I had a whole bunch of characters, the most popular of which was called the Mad Hussy. So what I would do is I would wear like a leotard and fishnets underneath and for the reveal right at the end. But on top of that, I basically dressed like a bag lady. So I would take balloons and blow them up and put them underneath this like horrible dress I was wearing to make it look like I was enormous. And wear this like rain hat and carried a bowling bag and this horrible wig and horrible glasses. And I can tell you, this was actually some of the most liberating stuff I've ever done in my life, because I basically had permission to go into restaurants, homes, offices, golf clubs, every kind of place you can imagine, and just be as obnoxious as I felt like being. So I would have the info, I'd arrive at the place. So let's imagine it's a big 50th birthday party. This was very typical. They would order me for like 50th birthday parties. And I would go in
there. That's a really specific market niche.
Oh yeah. I would go in screaming at the top of my lungs. Okay, you ready for this? I'll give you a sample. John, where have you been? I've been waiting for you out there on that street corner for 2 hours now. Right.
That was amazing.
And then there would be this, and I would do this for 5 or 10 minutes. And basically I was accusing him of standing me up on a date. And that I was his girlfriend. And I would bring in all of this detail about, you think you're so fancy. I saw you driving out there the other day in that fancy Cadillac of yours, and you and your wife and all of that. I don't know what you're telling people back at your Microsoft or whatever. I would just weave the detail in, and, you know, they were often horrified, but pretty much figured it out. So after about 10 minutes of this, I would tell them that, well, you know, they have no idea what they missed. And then I would take off all the outer costume and be in the leotard and fishnets and heels and this and that and sing them their song. And then I was off to the next one, which could have been Polly Darton. I did, which was like a Dolly Parton kind of thing. I had these like, you know, spandex jumpsuits and wigs. I have one called the Red Hot Mama. I did a nurse sometimes. I did a cop sometimes. I did a belly dancer sometimes. And then I even did a big pink gorilla, because they had a, you know, a big gorilla costume because they were called Monkey Business. So
that job sounds incredible.
It was great. It was really great. I mean, I can tell you it was really fun and really cathartic. And, you know, I think as someone who's interested in culture, it was kind of amazing to me to be able to break culture, right? With permission.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I thought it was really, really great fun. So,
another question you had a good response to, I thought this was a was you actually had a really elegant response. The question was, what is some general advice for a new PhD student? And your response was, design the project that you most want to experience. And you said that you had studied gamers and traveled to 13 countries. And there wasn't, I mean, I imagine there must be more detail on that somewhere on Quora, but this was just an answer that only had that detail. So do you think you could tell me about this project and what spurred you to take it on and why you wanted to experience it?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'll tell you first of all, so my undergraduate degree is in anthropology. I went to UC Berkeley, which is well known for its anthropology department. But I left that program really having no idea what I wanted to do. I did some physical anthropology, I did some archaeology, I did some sociocultural anthropology. And my focus was really more on the kind of sociocultural anthropology, but I was studying langur monkeys and, playing with skulls and, all sorts of things you do as an anthropologist. And so when I graduated, it was in 1993, which was the year the Mozilla's first browser came out, NCSA's browser. And so I got on the graphical internet. I had been on the pre-graphical internet before then, but I got on the graphical internet and I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. We need more. And so I spent a bunch of years in technology and user experience jobs. And then in 2000, I was working at TowerRecords.com, which was Tower Records was kind of falling apart at that point. And so I made a deal with my boss that he would lay me off and I would go to graduate school. So I got a degree in education and spent some time working in e-learning. But I actually found that to be really sort of frustrating just because of kind of where we were and where we still are to some extent in how we think about learning and education and training and all of these things. So I found that mostly people wanted to take their existing training and just make it sort of more digital and more engaging. We call it learning, scholars call it chocolate covered broccoli. So take the same icky stuff, but just make it more palatable somehow.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so I got really interested because I was already a big online gamer and was playing a lot of MMOs and just seeing these cultures that were thriving and, beautiful and cooperative and where people were learning very, very complex systems essentially from each other, right?
Yeah, have you read the book Play Money?
I have. I know Julian DeBell.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so, nice.
Yeah, he's kind of, we used to be in a guild in World of Warcraft together. He's an awesome guy. Yeah, he really knows his stuff. So I was just super interested in all of this organic learning that was happening, where people didn't even really know they were learning. They were just learning in pursuit of their entertainment goals. And so I was looking at these spaces and I was particularly interested in a game called City of Heroes, which is now defunct, but that's the game that I studied. I was looking at these spaces and just thinking, oh my gosh, if kids were learning like this in school, people would be thrilled all day long, right? and especially since it's all like self-motivated learning and people, figure out where to find the information they need, et cetera, et cetera. So I started playing with the idea of doing a PhD. I had just moved to New Zealand and was lucky to be connected via social media to someone who would end up being my supervisor for my PhD project. His name was Gareth Schott, and he's a really great games scholar, media scholar as well. So I ended up in the Department of Screen and Media Studies at the University of Waikato, which is on the North Island of New Zealand. And when I designed, you know, the project that I would be doing for my dissertation, someone gave me that piece of advice. You know, design the project that you want to experience, that you want to live. And I thought to myself, well, what do I want to do? Well, I like playing games, you know, so that's great. So obviously I have to write that in. And another thing that anthropologists use as a core research method is something called participant observation, which doesn't mean what you think it means. It's not about observing participants per se. It's about becoming a participant of the space you're observing, if that makes sense, in order to observe it.
So yeah, that's exactly what he did in Play Money.
Right. So it's, he uses ethnography as well. So it's highly subjective, right? Which, you know, the hard sciences tend not to be very comfortable with. But our perspective is that if you want to understand a culture, you have to understand it from the inside out, not from the outside in, right? And I've done work in labs too. I mean, a lot of the user experience work and usability work I did was in laboratory settings. But my preference is to sort of go into people's homes or to go where they already are, or in this place, particular project, spend a lot of time in the game that I was very interested in. But then, because world travel is kind of my thing, and I thought, well, I'm designing the project I want to live. I also designed 6 months of field work, which encompassed 13 countries. And so I went from country to country and soaked up gamer culture, I guess is what you would say. So started in New Zealand, went to the US, went to Europe, several countries in Europe, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Sweden, a few places, then to Asia, and where I went to Korea, Japan, China, and Thailand. So that gave me just, you know, sort of a sense of what position or how gaming and play are situated in these various cultures. So to give you an example of a major difference, when I interviewed a participant in Korea, one of the things she said to me that I thought was really insightful was she said, you know, I think it's so strange the way you all are in America that you tend to talk about games as if some people play them and some people don't. She said in Korea, the South Korea, everyone plays games. It's just a matter of what kinds of games you like to play. And I thought, yeah, that is really funny. Because, you know, you wouldn't go up to a person in America, for example, and say, you know, do you watch movies? Well, who doesn't watch movies? I mean, it's the very rare person that doesn't watch movies, right?
Although, well, my impression of gaming in Korea is that, at least when it comes to, like, very serious gamers, like, the very serious gamers in Korea are, like, really, really dogged about their pursuit. Like, it is, is that accurate? Like, it just seems like there's a higher degree of intensity to, I guess, particularly South Korean, obviously South Korean.
Yeah, South Korea does. The Chinese are really into gaming, too. You know, here's what I would say about that. Is that I wouldn't say it's a higher degree of intensity than, say, Americans or Europeans. I mean, I think gamers globally are more similar than they are different. And they're all kind of intense about their passions, you know, especially at the kind of hardcore uber end of the scale. But I will say that in places like China, Korea, Japan, there are simply more gamers. So, you know, the cacophony or the noise associated with those endeavors, I think, is much greater. And, you know, you also hear stories, you know, about people in the gaming cafes, which is much more common. So the thing about Asia that's different as a culture is you have a lot of extended families living together. So gamers often try and escape, you know, their families, I guess, and go to cafes in ways that we don't as much in the US, where we have larger homes and we, you know, tend to live alone and we have.
That makes a lot of sense. I knew about the cafes, but I didn't really I didn't understand the fact that, you know, this it was their popularity is partly a function of the fact that you have families living closely together.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, also I spent a lot of time in gaming cafes, and that was one thing that was really interesting to me, is just how different they are from country to country. So in Japan, for instance, you go in and they're typically gaming and manga cafes where you can get, you know, manga graphic novels, or you can watch videos or what have you. And they literally have little cubicles that are the tiniest little cubicles you have ever seen in your life, where you can go in and you know, do whatever you want to in private. In Korea, on the other hand, there are these kind of wide open spaces. They're often in basements. They're colored with these, you know, wonderful like LED lights, and they kind of have this feeling of being in like a fish tank. And they have like love seats in there so that couples can game together. And it's a like totally social experience. And then in China, you know, it's a whole different thing where you have, you know, huge rooms of people, you know, gaming together, but not speaking to each other. So I found some of those differences to be really interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. When I was in my senior year, I wrote a paper on virtual economies. It really got me. I ended up scratching the surface of a lot of different cultural aspects of gaming, and unfortunately I didn't get to delve into a lot of it. But you shedding some light on that it definitely adds another dimension of how rich this culture is.
Oh, it's more weird and more wonderful than you could possibly imagine. And there are dark spots as well.
Yeah, like people dying in those cafes?
Yeah, that's happened. There was a guy who killed another guy who stole his epic sword. There are stories of people not wanting to go to the bathroom anymore, so they get Depends and wear them so they don't have to leave their computer when they're in the middle of their epic raids. I mean, you know, that just goes to show you that, you know, some people will take any behavior to an extreme. I think vilifying games is completely wrong. You know, from what I've seen, you know, 90 to 95% positive experiences, right? And you can always gravitate towards the places that are more comfortable for you. You know, if you don't like to be ganked, you know, you can find a game, you can find a server, you can find a place, you know, where that doesn't happen as readily. If you stay out of PvP or player versus player play, for instance, you know, that keeps you relatively safe. Yeah, some of the most beautiful examples of community I have ever seen in my life are in some of these online games. And examples of leadership and support. I mean, the thing that's really interesting is how guilds, for instance, or whatever the groupings happen to be in any given game, become support networks for people. You know, it just kind of shows you how many sort of lonely, isolated people there are in the world. And I guess at least, you know, there's some place for them to go and, you know, where they feel like they can belong and where they feel like their contributions are valued. I think that's the thing that's the biggest difference, is that online games are absolute meritocracies. Nobody can see what you look like. Nobody can see if you're disabled. Nobody can see if you talk funny. Nobody, you know, can tell your gender, as an example. So all of those barriers that we experience in our physical lives are sort of dissolved, and then you get to experience different permutations of people, I guess. So I think they're beautiful. I love online games. I love the people who play them.
Definitely. So stepping back a bit, You were briefly in the military, and you trained to become a signal intelligence voice interceptor, and that's a role that's now known as a cryptologic linguist. What's the function of this role?
Well, in the day, when we were still in the Cold War, which was when this happened, so I joined in 1987, and if you'll remember, Germany was still divided, East Germany, West Germany, and there was still the big wall down the middle. Well, we had huge operations in Germany after World War II, and still do to some extent, although they're shutting some of them down. The idea being, you know, that we needed to keep an eye on the East Germans and the Russians and all of this, you know, because we were in this Cold War with them. So essentially what would happen is the U.S. military would set up posts. So they were either permanent, like, listening posts to listen to communications on the quote unquote enemy side, or they had field operations as well, where you would, you know, take communications devices out into the field and, again, listen, to traffic, to, you know, see if your enemies, you know, were doing anything they shouldn't be. And so this was really, you know, sort of the function of this particular kind of job, and for linguists across a variety of languages. Now most of the linguists are, you know, learning Arabic and Farsi and, you know, more Middle Eastern languages. But when I was in the military, it was, you know, Russian and German and those languages. And the sign in front of our barracks, funnily enough, said, "We're learning Russian, so you don't have to." So I actually got out of the military early. I got out pretty much right at the end of my training as a linguist. So I went to basic training, and then I went to my training as a linguist. And then I probably would have gone to Germany or somewhere, you know, to be a part of one of these listening posts. But I had a knee injury, and they offered to let me out, and so I decided to get out and go to college instead, so that's what I did.
You have an interest in UFOs and extraterrestrials. Where does this come from?
Okay, well, I guess I would say, so I'm technically what they call a contactee. So when I was 5 or 6 years old, I had some luminous beings that showed up in my bedroom in the middle of the night, and I remember that really clearly. There wasn't a lot of interaction, except they were there, they were glowing. They looked at me, I looked at them, they looked at me, I looked at them. I woke my mom up, said, "There's people standing at the end of the bed, they're staring at me." She said, "They're your guardian angels, go to sleep." I said, "Okay," I went to sleep. But I remember that, you know, for a long time. And I was seeing a lot of other things at the time, too. I had to be taken to the psychiatrist because I was seeing all sorts of things, like floating around the room, and wasn't able to go to sleep at night because I was staying up watching all this stuff like that was floating around all the time, and et cetera, et cetera. I was also raised on Star Trek, you know, which I think is an important informative experience. My mother was interested in UFOs, all of those kinds of things. And then when I was in South America as a teenager at 16, I happened to see a very large orange orb UFO in Chile when we were staying out at the farm. And it was strange enough. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning or something when I saw it. I'd woken up. It was outside the window. That I woke everybody up in the house to like go see it. So, you know, it wasn't, you know, really sort of a normal thing. And what was interesting to me was the response from the Chileans that I told about this. They said, "Oh yeah, the UFOs, they're always here. They're taking water from the lakes," was their theory. And then they all taking what? Water from the lakes.
No. I mean, it's just incredible that they were just
telling stories. Like UFOs. Grandma, you know, of the family who was like 90 years old, was telling me this story about how her husband had run into a UFO, you know, when he was coming back from town one day, and the UFO basically stopped him in the middle of the road, and he had to get back home, and then it followed him and landed on the front lawn of their house. And I mean, And this was a woman that, you know, appeared to be sort of, you know, elegant and conservative and all of these kinds of things. And she's telling me this whole story. And I was like, wow, okay, that's really interesting. So I guess that's where, you know, my interest began, I guess, because I've had experiences that indicate to me that these things are possible. I think as a scientist or as a person who's, you know, interested in reality and our experience and all of that, I mean, it's very, very clear to me that in a universe as vast as the one we live in, and that's just what we can see, by the way, right? There's 70% of the universe that we can't see, that's like dark matter and all of this kind of stuff. And then there are multiple dimensions right on top of it. That it seems very obvious to me that the possibilities for life are extremely great. And I guess I kind of follow the Drake equation. I don't know if you're familiar with Frank Drake's equation, but he basically did this whole probability sequence where he defined, like, you know, the number of planets, the number of galaxies, the, you know, possibility of advanced intelligences, and whether they could have gotten propulsion that would get them here, et cetera, et cetera. You know, came up with this equation that basically suggests that it's pretty much impossible that we're alone. If we exist, it's likely the universe is teeming with other life. So,
does that equation say anything? Does it say anything about the implications of, like, what are the odds that they've discovered us or run into us, or does it just say, like, there's probably
It doesn't go that far. There's another one called the Fermi paradox, and the Fermi paradox actually says, well, okay, let's take the Drake equation to be true, but if it's true, then why aren't they here? So the answer to that question, grasshopper, is that they are here, and they have been here. They've been here the whole time. So, like, you know, thousands of years at least. Now, in the last 60 years, they have gotten much more interested in us. And the reason for this is because we began experimenting with atomic weapons. So you'll notice that sightings of UFO craft and experiences with UFOs, et cetera, really gained a lot of momentum in the 1940s. The extraterrestrials really don't like it when non-advanced civilizations, like non-spiritually advanced civilizations, I would say, start playing with nuclear weapons. It makes them very nervous. So they've been very active in the last 60 years. There's apparently been a grand government cover-up about this. The government doesn't want us to know about it for various reasons. One reason is that they, at certain points in history, were in cahoots with some extraterrestrials that weren't as nice as others. There are nice ones and not nice ones. A lot of the not nice ones are actually on the planet at the moment and are doing not nice things. But the story is that the bad guys are being kicked out, and apparently the good guys are going to be coming to help us soon and give us their technologies and all of these kinds of things, help us just develop as a civilization. And I guess I'm interested in that because it's clear to me that one of the problems associated with our planet is that we just don't have clear leadership. I mean, we all have amnesia, right? So none of us know anything about what our previous context was, if we had one, if we existed before this lifetime, if we exist simultaneously in other dimensions, for instance. I mean, there's all of these possibilities that we don't understand. You know, we're not clear about religion. You know, it's not clear to a lot of people whether our universe was created or sprung magically out of nothingness. I happen to think it was created. That makes sense to me. I guess you know, there have been so many UFO sightings in the last 10 years, and they just keep escalating in the crop circles. And there are transmissions as well that come through channelers from extraterrestrial beings who say that they're from the Andromeda Galaxy, from the Pleiades, from Arcturus, from the Sirius cluster, I mean, from all of these different places. And so it's just kind of a hobby of mine, you know. I'm going to be pretty excited when we have the Close Encounters of the Third Kind deal, though. Like, when the motherships come down, I think that's going to be pretty awesome.
And so is this hard to discuss with certain people? Like I could see a Thanksgiving discussion about the existence of extraterrestrials kind of going about the same way as, like, politics or religion, with half of the table just not taking the other half seriously at all.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, and I guess I've developed a certain level of comfort with it because it's something that, you know, I have talked about and, you know, have been interested in for a really long time. Here's my perspective on it as an anthropologist. There's actually a field in anthropology. There aren't very many people in it. I think there's, like, the lady who founded it and then maybe me. Called intergalactic anthropology. And basically, it's just an extension of what we anthropologists do already, which is to understand and record, you know, peoples of the world, or in this case, peoples of the universe. I have no doubt. There are very few things I say I have no doubt about. I have very little doubt that I think we will experience first contact, absolutely, in our lifetimes with extraterrestrials. I'm pretty convinced of that at this point. Because I do think they're here already. And I don't think they're getting here the same way they're getting here, or that we would get to places like via our space shuttle or chemical rocketry or any of these kinds of things. I think they have really advanced technology that allows them, for instance, to create wormholes and get from, you know, one spot to another simultaneously, so distance essentially doesn't matter. I think they know a lot about free energy technologies. So there's something called zero point energy, which is basically the idea that there's energy all around us and in everything, right? Which you know from your high school chemistry or physics classes, and that energy is harnessable. And once you no longer have the problem of energy, then you can start to think some really big thoughts, you know, and even time travel is possible. You know, some of these beings might be from our future, coming back in time to, you know, help shape, you know, the past to make our outcome more positive, you know, because we have been at a turning point where it could go either way, right? We've been on a path to destruction, no question. But I think the tide has turned, and I think we're going to make it.
All right. Well, right. Well, let's start to wrap things up by talking about Quora. Has Quora made you realize anything about yourself that you didn't already know before?
That I'm awesome.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
And humble.
No,
I'm just kidding. I know exactly what you mean. I know exactly what you mean, actually.
You know, the thing about Quora that's amazing is that it exposes latent knowledge, right?
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Yeah, so it exposes all of the knowledge that people have that they don't know they have or that they don't think anybody cares about. And I think what Quora has demonstrated to me is that there is value in my quirks, my eccentricities, all of the stuff about my life that doesn't fit into the nice, tidy box of my professional persona. You know, I'm able to be whole me on Quora in a way I'm not on other social networks.
Yeah, if that makes sense. No, I totally understand, totally agree. Yeah. So has it made you realize anything about others, about other people on Quora? Like, I mean, I'm sure the same thing that you just described holds true for them also.
that they're awesome, that there are so many awesome people in the world. You know, that's what I really think about, is just what a magical set of people they have, you know, managed to wrangle together into one space, you know, and their structures encourage cooperation in a really useful way. You know, there's a certain integrity, I think, to the way people in Quora develop their content, evaluate other people's content. I mean, you know, there's a few trolls and outliers and, you know, downvoters and all of that kind of stuff. But if you look at the core community on Quora, I think it's just so positive and so beautiful and such a great example, you know, of what's possible on the internet. And, you know, the thing that wouldn't have been immediately clear is that Quora thrives on its diversity. And that wouldn't have seemed obvious. I think a lot of people, if they had thought about making social networks that would include hard scientists and soft scientists and writers and artists and just, you know, the full range of diverse possibilities in our world, I think they would have wanted to try and like silo those people somehow. You know, you've got to have people who think the same way, right?
Yeah.
But I think we learn so much from observing how other people think about the same topics. That's what I love about it, is, you know, being able to come at something from just such a wide range of views. You know, I'm not an atheist, for an example, but I find it useful to understand their perspective. I'm not a Republican, but sometimes it's useful to understand their perspective. You know, and I'm happy to have a conversation with any of those people. You know, I have had very few conflicts on Quora, like two maybe. And they both ended up being fine, you know, in the end, so.
All right, and my final question is, do you see any similarities between people that use Quora really frequently and inveterate gamers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, there's a couple of different things. I mean, first of all would be just the passion and the fervor. You know, the thing about the intense Quorans and your intense gamers is once they find a thing they like, you know, they're all about it and they'll invest tons of time and tons of energy and are in a process of sort of, you know, constant creation. You know, I think of Quora and the people who spend a lot of time on it, I mean, in a way, we're giving gifts to the internet, right? We're trying to transcribe our individual consciousness. At least this is how I feel about it. You know, I'm leaving it behind, right? But in all these like little bits and snippets and things, you know, I have a kid, right? So for instance, I think, well, this is something, you know, that my kid could access at some point in time, and should she ever want to. So I think the passion is really important, but I also think just the comfort and love for community. And in the case of Quora, you know, the love of discourse. Now, there's a lot of discourse that happens in online games, but, you know, typically the activity is more about, you know, playing and reading and crafting and all of that kind of stuff. And on Quora, the game is discourse, you know, and it's not for everybody. Not everybody's into it, which is cool. If you're not into it, you're not into it. Yeah, but for those of us who really enjoy it, it's kind of like Mecca.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, kind of going back to what you were describing earlier with sort of recreating aspects that are tried and true in a way that is more enjoyable. Like when you were describing the broccoli dipped in chocolate, I was kind of thinking of the trend of gamification, you know?
Oh yeah.
And I definitely see that through and through in Quora.
Yeah.
You know, with the you know, incentivization of you know, ask to answer and you know, getting points based on upvotes.
You know what's funny though? I mean, I know quite a lot about gamification, and I recognize that those are gamification elements, but the reason I use them, it has more utility than simple, you know, dopamine rewards. It's because those mechanisms, the upvoting, all of those kinds of things, allow the cream to rise. And that's one of the most important things in an information complex world, is being able to quickly identify which content is useful. So that's why, in particular, the upvoting mechanism really works for me. I used to think a lot, too. I don't know if other people do, but I think a lot, and, you know, but I know, I look at my views, and probably only 2% of the people who are viewing my content are interacting with it.
Lisa Galarno, thanks for coming on the Quoracast. I look forward to reading more of your answers on Quora.
Great. Well, thank you very much. This was fun. So thank you.